Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Goethe Institute Boston, the American Council on Germany, and the literary journal AGNI. Speaking will be author and poet Hans Magnus Enzensberger. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
We are particularly honored to have today as our speaker Hans Magnus Enzensberger, the former German poet, author, and, if I may use such a word, public intellectual. He was born in Germany in 1929, but he resided in many other countries, for example, in Scandinavia, and very memorably in Cuba, and also in the United States. He's the author of many volumes of poetry and of fiction, essays, and travel writing. Also, he was present and is present in German and European and American literary life as an editor and founder of periodicals, as translator, and as a journalist. He received several very important literary awards, German and European, and he is a very strong presence in German and European social and political life. But most of all, he is revered as a poet. Now, please, Mr. Enzensberger.
Good evening. Well, first of all, I'm very thankful that I was not invited to give a lecture. I'm one of the few writers who never taught, so I'm not given to this form of conversation. And I'm glad that I'm allowed just to read my stuff and then have a conversation, because I feel more free in a give and take than in a monologue. I shall spare you my thoughts about poetry, because I think that poetry, if it is worth anything, it should be able to speak for itself. Theories come afterwards, not while you are writing. Since I've been at it for quite a long time, I can't assume that anybody has ever read a line of mine, and therefore there's also some old stuff which I'm going to read, not just the latest. This is something, I think, probably from the 60s, which is called Middle Class Blues. We can't complain. We are not out of work. We don't go hungry. We eat. The grass grows. The gross national product, the fingernail, the past. The streets are empty, the deals are closed, the sirens are silent, all that will pass. The dead have made their wills, the rains become a drizzle, the war has not yet been declared, there's no hurry for that. We eat the grass, we eat the social product, we eat the fingernails, we eat the past. We have nothing to conceal. We have nothing to miss. We have nothing to say. We have. The watch has been wound up. The bills have been paid. The washing up has been done. The last bus is passing by. It is empty. We can't complain. What are we waiting for? Something of rather the same stripe, but a bit more rhetoric in it. That's 60s rhetoric, if you... Okay. This is called a song for those who know. Something must be done right away. That much we know. But of course it's too soon to act. But of course it's too late in the day. Oh, we know. We know that we are really rather well off and that we'll go on like this and that it's not much use anyway. Oh, we know. We know that we are to blame and that it's not our fault that we are to blame and that we are to blame for the fact that it's not our fault and that we are fed up with it. Oh, we know. And that maybe it would be a good idea to keep our mouths shut and that we won't keep our mouths shut all the same. Oh, we know, we know. And we also know that we can't help anybody really, and that nobody really can help us. Oh, we know. And that we are extremely gifted and brilliant and free to choose between nothing and naught, and that we must analyze this problem very carefully. And that we take 2 lumps sugar in our tea, oh, we know. We know all about oppression, and that we are very much against it, and that cigarettes have gone up again, oh, we know. We know very well that the nation is heading for real trouble, and that our forecasts have usually been dead right, and that they are not of any use, and that all this is just talk, oh, we know. That it's just not good enough to live things down, and that we are going to live them down all the same. Oh, we know that there's nothing new in all this, and that life is wonderful, and that's all there is to it, and oh, oh, we know all this perfectly well, and that we know all this perfectly well. Oh, we know that too. Oh, we know it. Oh, we know. Well, now it's shifting terrain a little bit. This is about probably the most important mathematician of the 20th century, a man called Gödel, Kurt Gödel, who died in Princeton. And this is a homage to Gödel. Pull yourself out of the mire by your own hair. Münchhausen's theorem is charming. But do not forget, the Baron was a great liar. Gödel's theorem may seem at first sight rather nondescript, but please keep in mind, Gödel is right. In any sufficiently rich system, statements are possible which can neither be proved nor refuted within the system unless the system itself is inconsistent. You can describe your own language in your own language, but not quite. You can investigate your own brain by means of your own brain, but not quite, etc. In order to be vindicated, any conceivable system must transcend, and that means destroy itself. Sufficiently rich or not, freedom from contradiction is either a deficiency symptom or it amounts to a contradiction. Certainty equals inconsistency. Any conceivable horseman, including Münchhausen, including yourself, is a subsystem of a sufficiently rich mire. And a subsystem of this subsystem is your own hair, favorite tackle of reformists and liars. In any sufficiently rich system, including the present mire, statements are possible which can neither be proved nor refuted within the system. Those are the statements to grasp and pull.
Well, now this is... Then I have a sort of habit of writing about paintings, about image paintings. And, well, the thing about these paintings about which I write is that it is not sure that they really exist. So some poor Germanisten have been at it looking for the original described, and most of them have failed. Okay. Now, a shorter one, which is called Notice of Loss. To lose your hair, to lose your temper, if you see what I mean, your precious time. To fight a losing battle, losing height and luster, sorry, never mind, to lose on points. Let me bloody well finish. To lose blood, father and mother, to lose your heart, lost long ago in Heidelberg, all over again, without batting an eye, the charm of novelty, forget it. To lose civil rights, I get the message. To lose your hat, by all means, if it can't be helped. To lose paradise lost. What next? Your job. The prodigal son, to lose face. Good riddance. 2 world wars, 1 molar, 7 pounds of overweight. To lose, lose and lose again. Even your illusions long ago lost. So what? Let us not waste another word on love's labors lost. I should say not. To lose sight of your lost sight, your virginity, what a pity. Your keys, what a pity. To get lost in the crowd, lost in thoughts. Let me finish. To lose your mind, your last penny, no matter. I'll be through in a moment. Your lost causes, all sense of shame, everything, blow by blow, alas, even the thread of your story, your driver's license, your soul. What else? Ah, yes, this may be pertinent for today's America. This is a poem about security. I'm trying to lift the lid, logically, the lid on my private crate. It isn't a coffin by any means. It's just a package, a cabin, or, in a word, a crate. You know what I mean when I say crate. Come on, don't play the fool. All I mean is an average crate, just as dark as your own. Of course I want to get out, and therefore I knock. I hammer against the lid. I call out, more light. I gasp, logically, pounding away at the hatch. So far, so good. Unfortunately, for security reasons, my crate does not open. My shoebox has a lid, a rather heavy one, to be sure, for security reasons. Since we are dealing here with a container, a safe, there is no way out. For our liberation, joint action would logically be needed. But for security reasons, I'm all alone in my crate, in my very own crate. To every man his due, and hence for me to escape by joint action from my own crate, logically I would have to be out of it to start with, and this condition obtains logically for all of us. Thus, I break my very own back against the lid. Now, a chink, a narrow gap. The open country outside, covered with tins, containers, or just plain crates. In the background, the high rolling waves plowed by seaworthy chunks. The enormously distant clouds above, and lots of fresh air. Let me out! I proceed to cry feebly, with my tongue coated against my better judgment, covered with sweat. To make the sign of the cross? Impossible. To beckon? No, I'm short of hands. To clench the fist? Out of the question. And hence I cry. I express my regrets. Woe to me, my very own regrets, while with a hollow plop, the lid, for security reasons, comes down again over my head. What else? Yes, we have here a model toward a theory of cognition. Sounds a bit heavy, but isn't. Here is a box for you. A large box labeled box. Open it and you will find a box in it labeled box from a box labeled box. Look into it. I mean this box now, not the other one. And you will find a box labeled and so on. And if you go on like this,
you will find, after infinite efforts, an infinitely small box with a label so tiny that the lettering, as it were, dissolves before your eyes. It is a box existing only in your imagination, a perfectly empty box. Sightseeing. Something East European, maybe. But that's long ago. It's called, let me see, sightseeing tour. Over there, the old shoeshine boy, who can do without shoes, for his legs rotted away in the Far East a long time ago. This is the smoke from the shipyards. This cafe used to be packed with hawkers and penniless poets. Informers descended like mosquitoes and drank blood from little cups. Here there are the soft girls on sale for hard currency. The pavement is torn up. This is where the tanks came in. Here the emperor went for his drive in the summertime every day. Stadtwäldchen Allee, today Gorki Fasor. This is the Central Committee. That is the smoke from the stockyards. Here my friend Chandor was born before the Second World War on the first floor, where the daylight never came in. Do you see the smoke? The bridge over there was completely destroyed. Here, the well-to-do poets take their tea, grumbling softly, and there the new Hilton is going up. On this rickety park bench, an old man can sometimes be seen who sometimes tells the truth. He did not show up today, but the smoke. Do you see the smoke, the old smoke over Budapest? Okay, now something, a few things more, a bit more recent. Yes, I don't want to depress you, really. So here's an optimistic ditty. Every now and again, somebody will cry for help, and someone else will promptly jump into the water, quite free of charge. In the thick of capitalism, a fire brigade will arrive and put out your fire without asking you for your credit card. On Saturday morning, the town is teeming with people who do not brandish knives, strolling about calmly in pursuit of milk and cherries, as if peace were reigning supreme. A magnificent sight. This is rather private. It's called a tender stirring. My grandfather was a lucky man. He had no idea. Panting with appetite, he wore dapper hats and used to think he was in the right. At 79, hospitalized for the first time, he blinked and murmured, "What a shame. If I had known how charming they are, the young nurses at my bedside, how soft their hands. I would have fallen ill long, long ago." He made a small face, groped for the night bell, and died. Something about theology. Because, you see, I happen to think that, you see, there are poets who are specialists. Great specialists. It's the love poet, there's the nature poet, there's the political poet, and so on and so on. Each have their field to mine, you see. Somehow I feel uncomfortable with this kind of thing, because I happen to think that poetry is an omnivore, that it can swallow up and digest practically everything in human experience. So I'm not exactly a cleric. Here's a theological poem. Why not? Theology. Why not? But this is called Astral Science. His world... Oh, no, it's wrong. Well, it's about... Anyway, Astral Science it's called. His world, made of next to nothing, of spectral superstrings in ten-dimensional space, strangeness, color, spin, and charm. But the moment the cosmologist is hit by a toothache or tears down the ski run in St. Moritz, when he munches his chicken salad or lies with a lady who does not believe in bosons, when he is dying, his mathematical fairy tales dwindle, all the equations fade away, and he reverts from his beyond to the present world made of pain, snow, lust, chicken salad, and death. What else? Wasn't there something about God? Has there been something about God? Just hold on. No. I'm sorry. it's not translated or something. This is about shortcomings. No, I'm not a patch on the breakfast egg. It is perfect. Sometimes I regret that compared to the power pylon, I vacillate. The good-natured moss disarms me when I lust for revenge, and the rhino's thinking, straightforward as it is, I can only admire. Verily, my screwdriver will outlast my brain. I am impressed by the ant, the way it fumbles and fumbles for a crack in the wall, since I am lazy. An attractive idea to be soft of heart, like the fig, and selfless, like the light bulb. Sorry, oil and vinegar, pepper and salt, that unlike you, I am dispensable. One more. Okay, we have a declaration of war. We have, what else do we have? I think I take on the great goddess or the visit. Let's take up the visit. When I looked up from my blank page, there was an angel in the room. A rather commonplace angel, presumably of lower rank. You cannot imagine, he said, the degree to which you are dispensable. Of the 15,000 hues of blue, he said, each one makes more of a difference than anything you may do or refrain from doing, not to mention the feldspar or the great Magellanic cloud. Even the most common plantain, unassuming as it is, would leave a gap. Not you. I could tell from his bright eyes he hoped for an argument, for a long fight. I did not move. I waited in silence until he had gone away. Thank you.
I'm sorry to have stopped you from reading the great goddess maybe you should complete the program.
No? You want to hear the Greek goddess?
I would love to. Yes.
Well, it's a short one. Don't worry. It's called The Great Goddess. She keeps mending and mending, bent over her broken darning egg, an end of thread between her lips, day and night, mending. Ever new ladders, new holes. Sometimes she nods off just for a moment or for a century. With a jerk, she wakes up and starts mending again. How small she has become, small, blind, and tired. With her thimble, she gropes for the holes of the world and keeps mending and mending.
So I'm now going to ask you some questions, although you basically discouraged me because you said that there's nothing much to say about poetry.
Is it poetry? Afterwards. After the fact. Uh-huh. But I think to proceed from theory is not a good idea.
Yeah. So I would ask you about what you said, that poetry is omnivore, but... Or do you think that your poetry, that while you are writing poetry, you are acting within a political sphere?
Well, you see, the thing is that being an omnivore, it can't possibly do without politics. And the reason for that is that we can't do without, we can't pretend to be free of politics. And this may not be one of the main pleasures of life. I mean, I don't say that politics is something I sort of hanker after or would like to be bothered by, but it is a sheer question of self-defense. If you don't defend yourself, it will swallow you up. I mean, in Europe we have large experience of this sort of thing, and even in America every now and then there's a problem, isn't there?
Yes. I will be quoting from various texts that you at your declarations.
Yes.
You said that as a young man, when you were learning English and American poetry, one of the poets that you loved was Auden.
Yes.
And Auden said that he wrote every poem that he wrote, and he was a political poet as well. He said every poem that he wrote was written out of love. Now, your poetry does not touch love.
Oh, well, yes, no. It's a question of selection. It's a question. For example, there's a poem called about the superb qualities of my wife, which goes in quite into some detail, you see. Being an omnivore, of course, you can't. I mean, the erotic side of life is very important, and it should not turn into poésie rose. At the moment, there's a whisk in love poetry to become a kind of rarefied kitsch, you see. So that is also something I defend myself a little bit. So, no.
In the tradition of the poetry that I know the best, of East European poetry, there are no love poems about wives.
No?
No. Only up till, like in the, you know, English novel of manners, you know, only up till the wedding, and then...
Well, of course, there's the amour fou and all these things, which are all very nice, but... I somehow discovered, I don't know exactly when, perhaps later in life, I discovered that monogamy is not necessarily a bad idea.
But I was not really asking you this personal question. When I was saying that Auden was writing about love, it was also that he was much more autobiographical than you are. That you really are, as a poet in the text, you are really removed from...
You're
hiding your life.
I need to take my distance, that's true.
Your grandfather, and, the grandfather was the only...
Because literature is not just... some people use it as a means of exposure, but it's also a very nice hiding place. And taking a distance has, of course, because I'm also... I also became somehow something which they call an intellectual, and you can't really take the measure of something without a degree of distance. I had to learn this the hard way because being a German born, I was 17 at the end of the war, and so on. I won't go into that, but unless you were able to take a distance in these 12 years from what was going on, you had to, not to be identical with what the world outside you. So it's also perhaps a matter of self-defense. That's possible.
Yeah. It is, you said, in fact, this is very interesting, that when you started to write, your poetry was very angry, and you were writing a lot of, that there was a lot of rage because of the war. And that you said in one of the conversations that I read, one of the interviews, you said the language needed to be cleansed. And I wonder, when I was listening to the selection of the poems that you had today, I was wondering if this distance from the language, the distance that basically every poet has, but yours is very sarcastic, very, in a certain way, bitter, lack of confidence in the language. Is this
was probably very true when I started, because after the war. It was not just the war. It was not just the bombings. The bombings were perhaps not even, as far as I'm concerned, not my worst experience. The worst experience that the air was sort of poisoned. You lived in a... And then after the war, this, of course, there was a huge hangover of these 12 years. It didn't just disappear magically in 45. There was the old guys. Everybody from the Eastern Bloc has some experience about this because this lives on, it hangs on. It takes a lot of time to somehow, and then I felt at the time a little bit that I had to work in the sanitation department, you might say. But it is not a job which is a lot of fun, really. To the degree that things have improved, you might say, that a sort of more civilized society step by step came about, now I wouldn't be so loud. I was shrill and loud when I was young, if that is out of need, that is, if you can help it, why be shrill? So and I don't think I'm particularly harsh. I don't think I'm particularly satirical or so on. No, it's another thing. You see, which is interesting about poetry many poets, even great poetry, you can look for a long time and not find a trace of humor. And I think that doesn't agree with me. So you should. It's also a game. It's also a play with words. It's also some kind of jugglery and some kind of mental whatnot. You see. So why should you forbid yourself just to be? Especially perhaps in German letters, there is a long tradition of high seriousness and high moral ground and so on. You see. And I don't know. I feel that as a kind of constraint, which I don't want to simply. Each to his, according to his temperament, of course. I don't blame. I don't want to lay down the rule for other poets. Let them do whatever they like. If they want to be, if somebody wants to be pompous, it's a constitutional right. See.
Yeah. So I have just one more question. If I would ask you about your literary pedigree, who are the poets you would mention?
Yes. Well, there's the vice of reading, you see, which I acquired very early in the day. So there is a whole there's a whole crowd of, and I mean, going back to antiquity, you see, I'm also a little bit suspicious of the cult of originality, because I think you go on with something which has gone on for a long time before you, and it is quite foolish to pretend or to conceive of yourself starting from zero. That is neither possible nor it is desirable. So there's a lot of people also. I translate a lot from other languages also, and of course it's not purely altruistic. It's also an egoistic thing to do, because if you take this to pieces, this whole thing, you see how it works. You mm-hmm. see you see the tricks of the you learn the tricks of the trade. I mean, it's also a métier writing, of course, and that that is a help, and the stranger the thing you translate, the better in a certain sense, because it gives you an insight into another world. That's very nice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so thank you, and please ask questions.
I'm Stephen Kohlberg. I teach sociology at Boston University. I have three short questions. Your Landsmann Georg Simmel wrote an essay called Der Fremde, mm-hmm. The Stranger, mm-hmm. and he argued in that essay that the outsider, the marginal person, has a kind of special view. He called it a bird's eye view. He saw deeper and farther because of his outsider status. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could comment upon the stranger in the literary cultures, you know, the German, the Spanish, and the American, and if the stranger varies yes. across those three. Secondly, why don't we have in America the public intellectual, as you do in Europe? Thirdly, just briefly, in the social sciences in Germany, right after the war, German social scientists didn't want to look at their own social mm-hmm. science. The great distinguished tradition of German social science was discredited in part because of that war and the mm-hmm. Holocaust. And German social scientists then in the 50s looked outside and were influenced massively by American and English social scientists. Did that phenomenon happen in the world of writing?
Good question. Well, I start with the last question because it's fairly easier to answer, perhaps. Yes, there was, of course, a very strong invasion, if you want to call it, of Anglo-American culture, not just in literature, but all over the place. Music, of course, being an obvious example, and so on, film, what have you. But that doesn't mean, I think, that the particularities or the local traditions and so on have evaporated. In fact, it's a complicated process of give and take and resistance and admission, you see, and I think all society has this. You might say it has to do with the social immunity system. An immunity system allows all sorts of invasions; otherwise, we wouldn't have no bacteria in our body. But it also works against some things, and if you get an overdose, for example, of something, then there's a reaction, an allergy, or what have you. And so I think this to examine this in detail would be an interesting proposition, but it cannot be done in a short time, I'm afraid. Sociology is concerned. There have been there has been the American Bell and so on, all this long tradition of absorption of these things, but there have been also quite original things. There's theory of systems, for example, by Luhmann, is a very original venture which has no precedent in Anglo-American thought. And as far as philosophy is concerned, of course, there's a long history of rift of between Anglo-Saxon philosophy and continental. Okay, but I don't know. I'm not a specialist in anything. I'm a dilettante in everything. Then Also, the thing of the stranger is certainly true, but we would be hard put to define who is a stranger, because it depends on in what context are you a stranger. For example, poets, to take an example close to here, poets are a tiny minority, and some of them feel badly treated by society. Some of them complain and so on. It's an attitude I do not share, but it is prevalent, and because they feel alienated, you know, there's all these things. So it's going on within your own society. There are all sorts of strangenesses, if this plural is permitted. We have heard about immigrant. We have heard then globalization. Schoolmates of my daughter work in Hong Kong. Strangers. And, of course, the real fact is that in most places you are a stranger. In most places in the world you are a stranger, obviously. You are even illiterate. You don't know the language. You can't read. You can't read Chinese and so on. So it's a natural condition to be a stranger.
There was a third?
About public intellectuals.
Oh, yes. Well, there are public intellectuals. They exist in America, of course. They exist. And the thing is, when in Europe, when there's some conference, some symposium, something like that, there are always a lot of American intellectuals there. And the strange thing about this is that none of them ever voted Bush. So you have a sort of problem, who voted for Bush? It's hard to answer this. I mean, this is just one indication. It doesn't mean much, but I mean, it's just an indication of the most, I think, probably the most rational and the most well-informed critics of American society are Americans. They may be a minority, they may be strangers, but I mean, there you are. They are there, and they are. They don't. Most of them are not rabid. They don't have a blanket condemnation of America. They are not anti-American in this French sense of the world. You know, that is. So I think there's. They may be beleaguered in some way, because also a geographical thing about America, which always struck me, that intellectuals in America, of course, they have fortresses. They are entrenched in fortresses which are called universities, you see. And then you step out of the campus, and then even the famous ones are not much heard of at the outside, probably. That is my hunch of mine, my impression, not more than that.
I'm Jay Rosalini from Suffolk University. We've heard much tonight about your sense of detachment, of the way you value distance in your work. I seem to remember, unless my memory is failing me, that there was a time when you turned down a fellowship to come to the United States.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then left. And it seemed at the time you put aside your skeptical stance and for a kind of political amour fou, you might say, and then went back to it later. Would that be an accurate characterization of your path?
Well, you see, I think there are situations. People don't choose the historical situations in which they find themselves. And intellectuals are least of all, because they have no power, normally speaking. So they find themselves in a given situation and they react to this. And, it was the time of the Vietnam War, and I felt very uneasy. You see, you want me to talk about this episode? I mean, it was like this. I was given a very, very generous fellowship at some university in New England, and they told me, you can do what you like. Yeah, okay. So I thought, why not? Let's try. And then it was in the middle of the war. And then, in a very genteel way, it was suggested to me that I should not to the students, I should not, I should avoid agitation, I should avoid direct involvement, I was a guest, so on, so on. And this became something, and how do you then, how do you deal with this? I mean, you can't shout at these people who offered you a gift. You can't protest against them. So you had to raise the stakes to get out of the situation. Raise the stakes, and then what happened that I fell into the politics of gesture. It was a gesture. And now I think not. I don't think very highly of politics of gesture. So it was just something visceral, perhaps, you know. And it's something that has to do. I don't deny that I have political passions every now and then. That's true, but only when I really feel like it, not because I ought to. It's not an obligation. It's something visceral, and then. Well, this whole 68 thing was nothing else but that, because it was, in Germany at least, every 75 years something like this happens, and why should I not? Why should I? This was very fascinating, and why should you keep away such an enormous experiment? It's a big social political experiment, such a thing. And of course, I'm not saying I was never a good comrade, probably, but I mean, at least it was something worthwhile. It was, and I of course, I got enmeshed in it, I don't know. There's a lot of nonsense also, like in all big social movements. There's always an element of lunatic fringe and this and that. You know? That's true. But I mean, in Poland, look at Solidarność. I mean, this was irresistible to a large part of, and probably the better, if not the best part of the intelligentsia in Poland was when at the time of Solidarność, they took part in this. They played, not in Germany, but in Poland, they played even a big role. They played a historical role. And then afterwards, when Solidarity degenerated, they quit. Wasn't it like this?
Yeah.
Well.
My name is Julian Mejia. I'm a student here at BU. And I'm a bit curious about your time in Cuba, because you label yourself as a poet who does not advocate any rights to action. And Cuba gave birth to José Martí, who devoted most of his writings to calling for a revolution. So I'm wondering what poetic style do you feel most successfully achieves giving political awareness to the reader? Your passive style, if I may label it like that, or Martí's very proactive poetry?
Ah, I see. Well, the Cuban thing for me was important because I come from a left-wing political culture, and that is why I took great pains to know the reality of so-called socialist countries. I spent time in Moscow, I spent time in Hungary. In fact, I've been to almost all communist countries except North Korea because I wanted to see for myself. Okay, because there's a kind of left-wing people who have their whole political ideas from books. And that is just not good enough because you have to go there. You have to go there and avoid the official stuff and get involved. Look, experience yourself. And my experience in Eastern European countries was I was satisfied that this will not work, that this was not the good, not the thing to do, that it was all with enormous sacrifice in the end. It petered out, it fell down of its own rate, not because of the missiles of America, but by itself. It did not work, quite simply. That was a very simple conclusion. And then, after having seen all this, China, you know, and it was always the same result. So I decided at one moment, let's make a best-case analysis. And what is a best-case analysis? It's a place where, roughly speaking, three-quarters of the people wanted to have a revolution,
where there were no Russian tanks, there was no outside pressure. They did it themselves. So I thought, now let's see if this worked. Maybe there's just this tiny little island, and maybe since they wanted it and they did it themselves, maybe it works there. It was the last straw, you might say. It was my last experiment, and it was deliberately so, and that's why I spent a whole year there. And from the minister of sugar industry to the last peon working the machete in the sugar field, I went through the whole thing. And I had reluctantly, because I loved the place, I liked the people and so on, quite reluctantly, I came to the same conclusion. It does not work there either. Now you can attribute, of course, the Cuban line is it's all fault of the Americans and so on and so on. But that's not the whole answer. There is something inherent in this. Also because it's a one-man show. It doesn't work. A society is always more intelligent than one man. That is a very simple sentence, but it's absolute true. So that's one of the reasons, because there's this caudillo. No. And in the end, that was it. So you have reality is a reality principle. You can't go on imagining things, not good enough.
So thank you so much. Thank you.
Author and poet Hans Magnus Enzensberger, speaking tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight's discussion was presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Goethe Institute Boston, the American Council on Germany, and the literary journal AGNI. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by Mike Toda and Tim Skog. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.